The train screeches into Union Station with a whistle and a chuff of steam. A man disembarks, breathes in the dry mountain air, and steps unnoticed into the slipstream of the new city, guarding his anonymity with silence and caution. Before anything else, before even showing his face in a hotel lobby, he must change his appearance. A barber will not be sufficient for what he has in mind. He heads down 17th Street in search of a beautician. Under the ministrations of a young woman whose curiosity about him must go unsatisfied, the man's gray hair is dyed dark brown, and so are his shaggy eyebrows and long mustache. The eyebrows are left to form a hood over his glittering blue eyes, but the mustache is trimmed and curled at the ends in a clumsy attempt at style. His thick hair is shaped into a supremely unflattering bowl cut, long enough in the back to form a roll of hair over his collar. The man begins to arrange his features to match his new appearance. Later, in his hotel room, he opens his valise and selects a straw-colored linen suit. It is light enough for the August weather, and it has a strap across the back that pulls the fabric into a little gather. He decides this unfashionable feature will aid his disguise, which is rapidly evolving to be that of a Texas cotton grower. He will hunch himself over, he thinks, like a man who has picked cotton his whole life. The suit's only liability is that its thin fabric cannot conceal a gun holster. He tucks a gun in at his hip and conceals it with his hand, as if his bones ache. A cane in the other hand, a small Panama hat perched on his new cut, and his disguise is complete. He spends some time before his bathroom mirror practicing his new slow gait. He pitches his voice up an octave and draws it out in a country twang. His features have settled into a pleasant, open countenance. And all the while, he runs through his story in his mind. He knows that his costume is important, but his story is crucial. Everything will depend on how convincingly he plays his role. He mentally rehearses the sequence of scenes, tries out a few improvisations. The man is confident the story will work. He has told countless versions of it, and he knows it well. And he knows the mark's responses almost better than his own lines. The mark has no idea how long the man has been studying his movements, actions, and habits. Only one task remains. The man sits down at his hotel desk and begins to write. In short order, he produces a small sheaf of letters, some of them in his own large, looping handwriting, and others in a smaller, feminine style. One letter in particular requires his utmost attention, a letter to himself, from his wife, back home in, he thinks for a moment, Ferris, Texas. He keeps it short and legible at a glance. Several phrases seem to leap off the page. The 100-acre oil lease and drillers have struck oil. Smiling to himself, he ends the letter with a truly heartbreaking expression of love and devotion, then proceeds to fold, crease, and stain his little collection of letters until they look as if they've been read and reread. He places them in a pocket, picks up his hat and cane, and sets forth on the downtown streets. It is time to announce his presence in the city. He slowly makes his way up and down 17th Street, his back bent, surveying the passers-by from underneath his hat and his eyebrows. It doesn't take long to spot his mark. He knew it wouldn't, and a small electric charge runs down his back. They are in front of the post office, and together with invisible choreography, the man and his mark enter the lobby. With deliberateness, the man hobbles to the general delivery window and asks loudly, "Any mail for L.A. Mulligan?" And the con has begun.